On April 3rd, video and photographs confirmed the combat loss of a Russian Su-35S fighter jet. This is Russia's most advanced fighter combat loss, not only of this war, but in the history of their air service. In this episode, I take a deep dive look at the shootdown of the Su-35.
This is the Air Minded Podcast.
Welcome back, Air Minded listeners. This is your host, Tyson Gorilla Wetzel, with another episode of the Ukraine Air War episodes of the Air Minded Podcast. The first three episodes in the series have been long and far-reaching discussions on the course of the air war, what it means, not only for the future of this conflict, but also for the future of air campaigns and air and space operations in 21st century battlefields. So I decided that instead of another long and very detailed discussion, what I wanted to do is a couple of quick, kind of hard-hitting and detailed looks at unique events that have occurred during the air war. I'm going to be shooting for about 20-ish minutes for each of these episodes, hopefully kind of digestible bites of little things that are happening in the conflict. In this episode, I'm going to discuss the combat loss of the Russian Su-35S fighter. I'll cover what we know about the incident, how the aircraft may have been lost, what I think happened, and why this particular loss is so important. A couple of notes that I want to give you just before I begin. All details on confirmed combat losses I take from Oryx. They keep a running tally of confirmed losses via pictures and video. And when you go to their site, and I'll put the site in the podcast notes. But when you click on every combat loss, it takes you to the video or the picture that confirms the loss. So unlike numbers that maybe you would get from the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense or another source, every one of these is a confirmed loss. And I think it's just an indispensable source for this conflict. The next note is that each system that I discuss, I'll give the Russian designator. Many of them are kind of alphanumeric, unwieldy designators. I much prefer the NATO name. So I'm going to give the Russian designator, the NATO designator, and then for the rest, once I've talked about it once, I'm just going to use the NATO name for the rest of the episode. And then all technical information on the Su-35, and I'll talk about some other fighters as well, is completely unclassified. It's all derived from either Jane's or Air Power Australia. If you're not familiar with Air Power Australia, I really like what they do. It's Aus Air Power, one word, AUS Air Power, one word, .net, AusAirPower.net. And now for my standard pre-episode disclaimer, and this one is even more, serious. I don't know the right way to say it. It's hard to be dispassionate about this particular war when you see what has happened. So I'm recording on Monday, April 4th, and over the weekend, there have just been some horrific images. So like I've said in the last few episodes, this is going to be a dispassionate look at, in this case, just one singular event of the air war. But it's impossible for me, at least, to stay dispassionate about this war and about the Ukrainian cause. As I'm talking, the pictures and video out of Bucha are absolutely sickening. It appears not just that Russia has been conducting horrific war crimes, but potentially moving into the realm of genocide, regardless of what the definition actually would be. It is absolutely horrific to see what is happening to Ukrainian civilians throughout the country, but really in particular, the images coming out of Bucha have been shocking. The last couple episodes, I've talked about different organizations that, if you're so inclined and you want to try and help the Ukrainian cause, these are organizations that I trust and that I give to. In the first couple of episodes, I talked about the International Rescue Committee at rescue.org, Come Back Alive at comebackalive.in.ua, and then Team Rubicon in the last episode at Team Rubicon USA. Again, one word, Team Rubicon USA.org. This episode, something totally different for me, but an organization that I really like. It's called World Central Kitchen. For those of you who know Chef Jose Andreas, I think he's amazing. Whenever there's a crisis or humanitarian disaster in the world, it seems like Chef Jose is rushing there. He starts cooking and providing meals free of charge for those in need. It is amazing to me to just see one individual who uses his fame and his popularity for such good, seemingly for no other alternate reason or cause. I just think Chef Andreas does amazing work. And this conflict is no different. Chef Andres is there in Ukraine. His organization is providing hot meals to those in need. He actually went to Bucha this weekend. I really can't say enough good things about him. If you want to help him and his organization, feel free to read about their work and consider donating at donate.wck.org/chefsforukraine, all one word, chefs for Ukraine. If that's too much for you, just wck.org. And with all that said, let's get on to the Su-35 shootdown. All right, now I'm going to get into the actual discussion of the Su-35 loss. I'm going to break this discussion up into four parts: the facts of the shootdown, the importance of the loss, what shot this thing down, or if it was even shot down, and then how will this affect, if it will affect at all, Russian air employment and Ukrainian air defense employment. So let's start with the facts of the shootdown. The video and photographs appear to show that at some point during the daylight hours of April 3rd, a Su-35S Flanker E, or Echo, was shot down near, as always, I'm going to butcher a city name here, Izyum, I-Z-Y-U-M. I'm sure I got that wrong. It's in the Kharkiv Oblast. It's about 120 kilometers southeast of the major city of Kharkiv. It is kind of in between there and the Donbass. It is just shy of 200 kilometers east-northeast of Luhansk and about 200 kilometers north of Donetsk. This is important because it's not where we've been seeing a lot of air activity that has been going on. Most of the losses have been happening up near the capital of Kyiv or near Kharkiv. Those are the primary areas where we've been seeing a lot of losses. We've seen some helicopter and ground attack losses in the south as well. But especially, and again, like I said, I'm recording this on April 4th, it appears that the Russians have completely changed their strategy, and I'm convinced that they changed their strategy not because they're brilliant strategists, but because they, I mean, there's no other way to say it. They've been getting their butts kicked, and as they've been bled dry or bled white, if you will, in the north, they have realized that the game is up on taking the capital and really any of the major cities in the north. They did have early success in the south, and now they really seem to be in an area where they just want to consolidate what they have in Donbass, and they've moved north from Crimea, and I think they want to consolidate that land bridge from Crimea to the Donbass. And also, just remember what Clausewitz has told us, right? War is just an extension of politics. The purpose of this war, of their change in strategy, is to provide Russian politicians and those individuals that are going to be working the peace negotiations, which is how most wars usually end, is with a peace treaty of some sort. But they want to provide a win in some way for Russia, and they're not going to take the whole country. They're not going to take the capital. They're highly unlikely to either kill, capture, or flush President Zelensky from Kyiv. So what is left? I think a victory for Putin would be to take not just the separatist-controlled areas of Donetsk and Luhansk in the Donbass, but to take all of Donbass. If they have physical control, the Russians, I mean, have physical control of all of the Donbass, then they're going to have a strong negotiating position. And even if President Zelensky doesn't want to officially recognize Russian control, it's going to be tough for him to take a hard line if Russia controls all of Donbass. So we have seen them start to reposition forces and certainly at least start to move out of the capital and other major cities in the north. We've seen a little bit of reinforcement in the east, in the Donbass, the east of Ukraine, the Donbass region. And that's where I think the next campaign, phase two, if you want to use what the Russians, kind of the verbiage that they use. So that's where the major fighting is going to happen. The fact that we saw a Su-35 loss sort of in that area, I mean, we're still talking 200 kilometers away from Donetsk and Luhansk, so 120-ish, 108, I think, nautical miles. It's still a little bit of ways away, but it is saying that the fighting, and in particular, the contest for air superiority is going to start moving, I believe, to the Donbass region. So just that just taking where the loss happened, we can learn a little bit about where Russian air activity, especially their high-end Russian air activity, this is their most advanced aircraft that I'll get to in a minute, at least that they have in theater. They lost that in moving towards the northeast region of the country and moving towards the Donbas. It also tells us that there are some pretty significant air defense assets, and we'll try and figure out what may have shot this thing down. But it's likely that there's some pretty sophisticated air defense systems that are over in that region. What do I think this all means is that the fight for air superiority is going to move to Donbas, and that's kind of where the next things are happening. Now, there was a video that appears to show the aircraft as it's coming down. It's trailing smoke. That, in and of itself, I don't think that that video, to me, confirms whether it's a shoot down or a loss to mechanical reasons. We can't, eliminate mechanical failure. However, the fact that the Russians didn't come out quickly and say, you know, it was a mechanical failure, it was not a loss, I think first off, they're on the back foot, but I tend to lean towards this actually was a shootdown. The Ukrainians, of course, have claimed it as a shootdown. They said the Ukrainian Armed Forces on their official Facebook page. So if you want a reason to still be on Facebook, I guess the Ukrainian Armed Forces official Facebook page said that the aircraft was shot down by air defenses, which they called, and this is a quote, which I don't know if this is a bad translation by Facebook, but Air Force Zenith Missile Forces, which I don't know what that is. But I think what they're trying to get at here and what other people have been extrapolating is that that is an air defense missile of some sort. And we'll talk about what that could be in a little bit. There's video and pictures of the pilot. Appears that the pilot was captured, apparently trying to evade after the aircraft was down. The aircraft, a picture of it, it pancaked down on the ground. You can very clearly see that it's a flanker. You can see that it doesn't have, or you can kind of tell by the way that it looks that it is probably a Su-35. And people who are much better at the imagery analysis are able to say through a whole bunch of different things that it is definitely a Su-35. There's also a couple of things that I think are really important for this shootdown that we are able to tell from the wreckage. The first is that on the wingtips, they're carrying L-265 or version of L-265 electronic countermeasures or ECM pods. This is jamming pods and also an ELINT pod. They were also carrying an anti-radiation missile known as the KH-31P or AS-17 Alpha Krypton. So again, I'm going to use just the NATO designator, the AS-17 Alpha. That's an anti-radiation missile that's very similar to the Russian HARM. So what can we tell from the fact that they had these jamming pods and the missile aboard? This aircraft was probably on a SEED or suppression of enemy air defenses mission. So that's the facts of the shootdown. So now I just want to talk about why this loss is important and start with what is the Su-35. So transitioning to why this loss is important, first let's talk very briefly about the confirmed fighter losses that Russia has suffered. So again, I told you I used Oryx, and as of today when I was looking, they've lost 9 Su-25 Frogfoot, or as my buddy Zeus likes to call it, frog feet in the plural. The best way to think about this ground attack platform is it's analogous to the U.S. Air Force's A-10 Warthog. It is a tough killing machine that's designed to be down low. It is no surprise that that is the aircraft that they're losing the most of. To be effective, especially in a close air support or ground attack role, you probably need to be a little bit lower. That's going to bring them into range of the Stinger missile and other pieces of air defense artillery or AAA that are in the region. And now as the Brits are sending their Starstreak missile, that's going to be very effective as well. We have seen the rate of those losses decline a little bit, and I think that is because they've been having such horrific losses of this aircraft, is that they are not as employing as much near the ground. They've lost 5 of their Su-34 fullback. So the next 3 aircraft that I'm going to talk about are all derivatives of the flanker family. So that is the NATO designator. The Su-34 is actually called the fullback, but it's in its DNA. It's a close relative of the flanker. The Su-34 is a twin tandem sit next to each other cockpit. It is a full multi-role fighter, but with incredibly good air-to-ground capabilities. And this is their primary air-to-ground platform or advanced air-to-ground platform. So if you have the Su-25 doing a lot of close air support, it's analogous to U.S. Air Force A-10. The Su-34 It's kind of tough to give a close approximation. I would say it's like the F-15E Strike Eagle in U.S. Air Force service in terms of its very potent air-to-ground capabilities. It does also have really good air-to-air capabilities. They just don't use it. It's sort of like an upgraded maybe F-111 Aardvark. So I would say it's like the U.S. Air Force's Strike Eagle. Just they're not as good at employing an air-to-air as our Strike Eagles would be. The next, so they've lost five of the fullbacks. They've lost four of the upgraded Su-30 SM flankers. And this is another, so this is another two-seat aircraft. So unlike the Su-34 where they sit next to each other, this one is front-to-back. This is the tandem cockpit. I got that wrong on the Su-34. And this one really is a pretty close approximation for the Strike Eagle. They've lost four of those. And then, of course, the one Su-35 loss. And the best analogy that I could give, or the best comparison, would I'd say this is like the new build F-15EX that the U.S. Air Force is building is buying, and have just started to take delivery in the new budget requests. They're asking for more of them, designed to replace as a one-for-one replacement the F-15C. It's got great capabilities. It's got kind of full Strike Eagle capabilities, but we're only buying it. The U.S. Air Force is only buying it right now to be an air-to-air platform. But in terms of capabilities, it's pretty analogous to the Su-35. So those are the losses that they've already had. That's 19 fighter losses. That's the equivalent of losing one entire squadron of frontline fighters. That's a huge amount. They've lost 10 of the flankers or fullbacks. So that in and of itself is a big loss. And not only on the equipment, but the air crew as well. And since they're flying over enemy territory, most of the pilots, if they are able to successfully get out, are being captured, they're injured, they're not getting back to fly. So you have taken nearly 20 crews out of circulation, and these are combat experience crews. Okay, let's talk about the Su-35S Flanker E. It is Russia's most advanced fourth generation fighter. They do have an operational fifth generation fighter, the Su-57 Felon. But that was not deployed in theater, and I have seen nothing to indicate that it has flown in this conflict. It did deploy to Syria and fly in Syria, the Su-57, I mean. But let's talk about the Su-35. Russia calls it its fourth plus generation fighter. So let me just take a minute to talk fighter generations. And first thing I will say is that these fighter generations have not been around forever. My understanding is that they just came into the nomenclature when the F-22 was out, and it's kind of almost a sales promotion of how great the F-22 is to call it a fifth generation fighter. And we kind of retroactively came up with generations. But I think it's a really good way of describing the different capabilities of fighter aircraft and then explaining why the Flanker E, the Su-35 that they lost, was such a big deal. So first generation fighters are the first jets. They have little to no avionics, no missiles. It's just guns, and it's subsonic, so can't go above the speed of sound. Things like the U.S.'s P-80 was America's first jet, but really came into its own in the jet fighting era of Korea, where it was the F-86 Sabre versus the MiG-15. Second generation, first time the jets are becoming supersonic. Speed is a real big driver of second generation fighters. They're starting to get very basic avionics to include some radars, early generation, primarily infrared guided or heat seeking missiles, but there are also at least some work on radar guided missiles, although they're very, very poor missiles. So aircraft that we would think of in second generation would be all of the US's Century Series fighters and then the MiG-21 in the Soviet world. One thing I do want to point out is just because an aircraft is born in a certain generation doesn't mean that it can't be upgraded. So a lot of countries that use MiG-21s for a very long time would continue to upgrade some of the avionics, put new weapons on them. So a MiG-21 that started its life as a second generation fighter, I think of how India upgraded their MiG-21s for a long time, could become a third or even fourth generation fighter. But just of the baseline kind of floor model, if you will, the MiG-21 was a second generation fighter. Third generation, again, a supersonic fighter, really starting to get some good multi-role capabilities. It is what I would consider federated avionics, so you're getting an improved radar You have some more sensor. You've got an ability to detect radars out there, radar warning receiver. Maybe you have a jammer. These are all federated systems that are not integrated very well. You have limited beyond visual range capabilities. The best way to think about these are, for me, is the F-4. And all, in the Soviet world, it would be the MiG-23. So some pretty capable aircraft in the Vietnam War era. Boy, when we were talking about first gen, I hope I said Korean War. I'll have to go check that as I edit. But anyway, so this would be the Vietnam War F-4, and then in the Soviet world, the MiG-23. That leads into the fourth generation fighters. Huge upgrade in capabilities post the Vietnam War. And in particular, America and the Soviet Union are really driving these developments. So one major thing is we've gone from federated to integrated avionics, in particular the look-down, shoot-down radar. So third-generation fighters had radars, but they really struggled to look down because there's clutter from the big Earth, which is usually the biggest radar reflector out there. But these new systems have the ability to look down and shoot down aircraft below them. Now we're firmly in the world of BVR, or beyond visual range. You can shoot people using radar-guided missiles from farther than you can see them. We're also seeing a thrust-to-weight ratio of greater than 1.0:1. And what does that thrust-to-weight ratio give you? It's a lot of really good maneuverability. So platforms in the U.S. world, F-15 and F-16, the FA-18, are good fourth-generation fighters in the Soviet-produced world, and then eventually in the Russian world. After the fall of the Soviet Union, MiG-29, Su-27, and those continue to be upgraded. And then the fifth generation fighter, really a whole generation just for the F-22 when it came out. The key here is stealth. We've moved beyond even integrated avionics to sensor fusion. It is a very software-driven aircraft. It also has super cruise and super maneuverability. Super cruise is the ability to go over the speed of sound without the use of afterburner, and then super maneuverability, as you would anticipate by the term, it's just a highly maneuverable platform. So the Su-35 is not a stealth platform. It has very good integrated avionics. I think it's tough to say it's full sensor fusion. And it has a lot of capabilities that are maybe beyond fourth generation, but not to the fifth generation capability. So let's talk about that and why Russia uses fourth plus plus. And that's just a clever way of them trying to sell some of these aircraft. And they haven't sold a ton of them. So the Su-35 is a single-seat fighter. It's a twin-engine fighter like all in the Flanker series. It's got a really capable engine. Depending on what you see, it's sometimes known as the Article 117S, sometimes the AL-41. It is capable of super cruise. It has thrust vector control, so the exhaust coming out of the nozzle can be vectored to help with maneuverability. When they sell it, they say it has super agility. So some of those capabilities are very much fifth generation, or at least in the fourth plus plus generation. Where they fail to meet fifth generation would be in stealth, in particular in radar cross section. But that said, the Flanker does integrate RCS, or radar cross section reduction techniques. The best estimates online is that in the open press is that the Su-35 is down to about 1 meter square target. So when what a radar sees would be the equivalent of a circle that's 1 meter around. That, to try and give you an example of another fighter that would be about that size, would be an F-16 that is not carrying any external weapons or fuel tanks or anything like that. So it's not stealthy by any means, but it does reduce its radar cross-section, meaning that the detection range against it is shorter. So it helps out and moves towards, but in no way in fifth-generation stealth capability. Where the Flanker, where the Su-35 really makes its money is in a fully digital cockpit and really, really well integrated, we think, avionics. So the heart of that is its N035 Urbis radar, NATO designator Snow Leopard. You know we're going to go with that one. The Snow Leopard, according to the Russians, are able to detect fighter-sized targets out to 400 kilometers. That's greater than 200 nautical miles. And they claim to be able to track up to 30 targets. You only have 8 to 10 missiles aboard, so that's not really all that effective. But the point is, it's a very good radar. And supposedly it is integrated with some of the other sensors aboard the aircraft to include passive RF, radar, radio frequency detectors. It has, I think I mentioned, a full glass display, two really large full-color multifunction displays. If you've ever seen a cockpit of an early Flanker, just buttons and switches everywhere, this goes to the full glass cockpit. It has a very sophisticated electronic warfare suite, and this is going to be very significant for this potential loss or for this potential shootdown. It's got what sometimes is called the Kabini electronic warfare suite or defensive avionics suite. This is one where we don't have a NATO designator. I'm just going to call it the L-265. It's actually the L-265M10, blah, 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 but we're just going to call it the L-265. It is a really sophisticated jammer. It's also a passive detector to determine what's out there and then go out and be able to jam it. It can be used in self-protection, or it can also be used in seed or suppression of enemy air defenses to jam air defenses on the ground. Back to the integrated avionics, it's got sophisticated communications and data link systems as well. In terms of weapons, it's got a huge combat load. The Su-35 is even larger than the F-15 Eagle, the mighty, mighty, the venerable F-15. It's huge, and it can carry a lot of weapons, up to 12. If you're carrying the jamming pods on the wings, which this jet was, then it could be down a little bit less than that. It could be at 10 missiles, but they can also carry huge missiles like, in particular, the AS-17 that I was talking about, the anti-radiation missile. It also has the ability to carry Russia's most upgraded infrared missile that they call the R-74. We would call that the AA-11 Bravo, AA-11 Archer, and then they have the upgraded R-77 or most upgraded AA-12 Adder. It also has an electro-optical system known as the OLS-35. It's an infrared system, electro-optical system, so that they can see and sense targets visually and via heat. So a lot of really good capabilities. First flight in 2008. It was introduced into Russian service in 2014. They declared full operational capability in 2018. It is a multi-role platform, but it is their primary air superiority fighter. Even as they've bought the Su-57, this does the bulk of air superiority. But because it has a lot of really good seed capabilities, we believe that they've been using this platform to do seed in the conflict. And we think of that for a couple of reasons, not just the one that was shot down and had an anti-radiation missile that they laid on the ground, but also because even before the conflict and then also during the conflict, the Russian Ministry of Defense has released videos of this aircraft operating at airfields in Belarus. And I should mention they did deploy 12 of these forward to Belarus. But as we saw videos released by the Russian Ministry of Defense, it showed both the jamming pods and the AS-17 anti-radiation missile aboard. So it seems like they're doing anti-radiation, or they're doing seed missions. This aircraft cut its teeth in combat in 2016 in Syria and continued to be out there. In terms of sales, they've sold 24 to China, 24 to Egypt. Egypt, the delivery is still ongoing. Best guess, based on numbers I've seen in the open press, is that Russia has about 100 of these aircraft. So anyways, it is an awesome aircraft. Do you remember from the last episode when I was talking to Dr. Kelly Grieco, we were saying, you know, what has Russia done poorly? And the joke she made is, what has Russia done right? I mean, basically, they haven't done anything right in terms of the air war. And I said, well, the one problem that they don't have is good equipment. This Su-35 is an excellent, excellent aircraft. Now, how they've actually been employing it, probably not as well. I think it's suffering from some of the operational planning deficits that some of the other aircraft are. But tactically, it is a very good airplane. So losing this is the most advanced Russian fighter that has ever been lost in combat, period. And I would contend, outside of the F-117, which I don't consider really a fighter, it's much more a bomber, you could certainly make the argument that this is the most advanced fighter aircraft that has ever been shot down in combat. That's a pretty big deal. The Russian Air Force will feel the loss of even one Su-35. They don't want that thing to be on the ground. Now, based on the pictures, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot that we'll be able, that either we or other countries would be able to exploit. That thing has been absolutely destroyed. It pancaked, it burned. But nonetheless, it is a loss that they will feel. And I think maybe important when we get to section four is, will it affect future employment of that aircraft? So let's kind of transition into section three, if you will, which is what shot it down. First off, let's talk about the maintenance issue. Is it possible that it was a mechanical issue? Absolutely. I can't discount that. The Ukrainians are saying that they shot it down, but of course they would. But at least the video I saw seemed to indicate that there was fire coming from one of the engines. I mean, is it possible that's a mechanical issue? Yeah, of course. I tend to lean towards this was actually a shoot down. So if it's a shoot down, there's really three types, I guess four types of systems. So the first would be any kind of anti-air gun, air defense artillery, sometimes called AAA, anti-aircraft artillery. It can reach, so AAA or ADA can reach well up to where this thing would fly, which would be greater than 30,000 feet, you would think, most of the time. But it's highly unlikely to shoot down a fighter. It's really a golden BB type of shot. So although we can't discount the fact that it was ADA or AAA, I highly doubt that was the cause of the loss. That leads into the second category of weapons, which would be man-portable air defense systems or the British Starstreak. I don't think the British Starstreak is in country in enough numbers that it is likely. I think it's if it was a loss to a man-portable air defense system or shoulder-fired missile, it was probably the U.S. Stinger. The U.S. Stinger can reach, depending on what you read, between 15 and 20,000 feet. That is potentially where this aircraft was operating, although you would still think with a Su-35, you'd want to be operating above that. They don't want this aircraft to be operating near the ground. It's not going to be a close air support platform like the Su-25 or a ground attack platform like the Su-34 that is trying to visually acquire targets or get below the weather. If they're doing a seed mission, they don't need to be below the weather. They don't need to visually identify. They would just identify targets via their electronic warfare suite and the missile itself. So is it possible that a manpad shot it down? Absolutely. And there's reasons why. You know, maybe they were at lower altitude because they had been engaging a target either in the air or on the ground. So we can't completely discount manpads. The next, which I will tell you right now, I think is the most likely, is that it is a surface-to-air missile that is not infrared guided. It is one of their big two, as I would call them, the S-300 or SA-10. Now, I should mention right here that the Ukrainians have both the S-300P and the S-300V, which is the SA-10 and SA-12. SA-12 is optimized against ballistic missiles. The SA-10 is optimized against air-breathing targets. So if it was an S-300 variant, I think it's probably the SA-10. What I haven't been able to confirm is that the SA-10 is out near the Donbas region. So I can't say for certain that it was the S-300. I think that is the most likely capability. The Su-35, especially since the SA-10 is a Russian system, should have very good capability to be able to detect and defend against that SA-10. So you would think if they were operating correctly, they shouldn't be shot down by the SA-10. My other option in this kind of category would be the Buk M1. Or the NATO designator would be the SA-11. SA-11 has the ability to reach the same altitudes that the Su-35 would be operating. It's well, actually, beyond where the Su-35 can operate. It is a mobile system, doesn't have quite the range of the SA-10, but it is more mobile even than an SA-10 battery or battalion. So the SA-11 could certainly be one of the shooters. So it is tough for me to say yes or no on the SA-10 or 11. I don't have confirmation one way or the other as to whether those systems are in the Donbas region, but I believe one of those is the most likely culprit. I think it's, you know, just gut, I would say the SA-10, but I can't prove that. So I think the most likely loss would be to the SA-10 or 11 SAM. The other kind of last category we should look at would be air-to-air engagement. And the Ukrainians, even though they're low on numbers of aircraft and they're not flying many sorties, according to best DOD estimates, only about 10 sorties a day, they do have the MiG-29, they do have the Su-27. Both of those are very capable air-to-air platforms. The MiG-29, that's a pretty far distance from the MiG-29 airfield, so I would say that's less likely. And even though the Su-35 is excellent in air-to-air, there's absolutely a situation that could develop where a less capable aircraft can shoot down a more capable aircraft. So we can't say for sure that there wasn't an air-to-air engagement. the reason why I don't think there was an air-to-air engagement is because I think that the Ukrainians would be bragging about it everywhere, that they had shot down a Su-35 in an air-to-air engagement. I mean, if we got all the press about the Ghost of Kyiv, can you even imagine what would happen to somebody who shot down the most advanced Russian fighter that was ever lost? I think there would be a lot that was coming out. So I think in the end, we're talking SA-10 or SA-11 is the most likely culprit for the shootdown. Section 4 is, how will this affect future employment? So first off, I believe that the Russians, and we've talked about in a lot of different episodes or throughout this arc, is that the Russians have done SEED really, really poorly. They didn't go kill the SA-10s and 11s on night one. They didn't kill command and control. They didn't kill communications. And thus, they are still struggling for air superiority, and these very capable systems like the 10 and 11 are still up and killing. I think that we are starting to see a change in tactics to really focus on killing these modern long-range SAMs. So in the last week, we've seen video and pictures of at least one and potentially two SA-10 sites that have been destroyed, including one that was overrun. There's another picture today of an SA-10 radar, the flap-lid radar that was clearly destroyed. It's unclear whether it was actually a Ukrainian SA-10 system, so I wouldn't call that confirmed by any means. But especially if we are taking all of these little bits of information and trying to determine what's going on, I think we're seeing a much more dedicated SEED effort from the Russians, in particular, to go out hunting SA-10s. I can't prove that. I'm using a lot of circumstantial evidence to try and bring it together. But I think their Su-35s are out there and trying to find, fix, and kill SA-10 systems. And that could have been what this thing was doing. Now, should a Su-35 be able to survive against an SA-10? Yeah, the SA-10 is very capable, but you would think that the jamming system aboard the Su-35 would be very good, would have great techniques optimized against the SA-10. So to get back to the fundamental question here of how will it affect future employment, first off, I think they're going to want to make sure that they keep their Su-35s at high altitude outside of Star Streak or man pads, you know, in Stinger range. I think they are going to want to do a very good job of making sure that every time these platforms are up, they're up with electronic intelligence or ELINT collectors so that they know what is up there and radiating so that they are not hit by a surprise SA-10 or 11. I don't think they're at the point where they're going to want to take these things out of frontline service. They still need to use it. It's still their most capable platform, and they haven't established air superiority. So I continue to believe that we're going to see some Su-35 employment in the future. I think there's going to be a little bit more, a little bit better about, at least I would be, and we don't want a mirror image, but I do think their tactics and techniques are improving a little bit. I think they're going to want to make sure that they have dedicated force protection and force support like intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets up there and operating with their Su-35s. But what I think potentially is even more important is that this is showing that the fight for air superiority is going to be fought less over Kyiv than it is going to be starting to move towards Donbass. So maybe that's what we can learn out of this loss. Anyways, that is it for this particular loss. I said I wanted to go 20 minutes, and I'm looking at the clock here, and it's 37 minutes. What a shock. I went over time. Anyways, that is the end for this first time of looking at just one episode. I'd love to hear what you think about this episode, and if there's another singular event that you want me to cover. I've got a couple of other ideas, but definitely hit me up on social media. I'm at Air Minded Pod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. Don't hit me up on LinkedIn. Also, you can reach me at airmindedpodcast@gmail.com. I've gotten a couple of emails from you all recently. I appreciate that. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so that you can see whenever I drop another one of these. I really appreciate it. And then my standard disclaimer, everything that I have just talked about is my own opinions. It is not does not reflect the official position of the Department of Defense or the United States Air Force. So with all of that said, that does it for this episode of the Air Minded Podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening. And until I see you next time, this is the Air Minded Gorilla, Tyson Wetzel, signing off.